Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you've ever thought of climbing Mount Everest, this is exactly the time of year to do it, mid-May to mid-June, before the monsoon sweeps up from India, snow cover at its firmest, days progressively warmer, and that's the good news. The rest, even now, is all challenge. 29,035 feet above sea level, the closest you can come to walking into space. Bitter cold, oxygen deprived, and deadly. And yet, the history of humankind and Everest is a history of longing for more than a century to be up there at the top of the world. 50 years ago, this week, on May 29, 1953, Edmund Hillary, a New Zealand beekeeper, and his Sherpa climbing companion Tenzing Norgay made history when they became the first to successfully reach the summit of Mount Everest. Here's how their triumph was reported by the BBC.
Mount Everest has been conquered by members of the British expedition. The news reached London in a message to the Times from Colonel H.C.J. Hunt, the expedition's leader. It said that Mr. E.P. Hillary, a New Zealander, and Tenzing Bhutia, a Sherpa, had reached the summit last Friday, May 29th.
Tonight, On Point, back onto the roof of the world, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first successful summit of Mount Everest. Joining me in the studio is a man uniquely qualified to talk about this extraordinary anniversary and mountain, David Brashears, filmmaker, adventurer, and mountaineer extraordinaire. He has made 4 trips to the top of Everest, and in 1983 transmitted the first live pictures from the summit. He also co-directed, photographed, and co-produced the acclaimed IMAX movie Everest. Good evening and welcome, David Brashears.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be here on this important anniversary.
It's terrific to have you. I don't know if we can fully appreciate today what it meant to the world in 1953 to have this mountain finally conquered. Try and take us back there for a second, David. Give us a sense of how much focus there had been and what it meant when these two men finally stood on top of Mount Everest.
Well, I'd like to take you back even further than May 29th, 1953.
Great.
To the moment when Everest was first discovered to be the highest, and that was in 1952. A human surveyor calculating measurements made about of the peak from India from a distance of over 108 miles away had finished his calculations and said, here's the highest mountain on Earth, and at that time it was 29,002 feet high. It wasn't until 1965 that the mountain was finally named Everest. But from that moment on, people, mostly adventurers, were fascinated with how they could get to this mountain and climb it. Of course, there were the first British expeditions, which had to find this mountain. It was just a point on a map. No one knew what it looked like, and they set off in 1921, and an important member of that expedition was George Mallory, the famous Because It's There, George Mallory. They found the mountain. They reconnoitered the best route to the top, returned to try and climb the mountain in 1922. They failed. 7 Sherpas died. They tried again in 1924. And on June 8th, 1924, George Mallory and Andrew Irvin disappeared into the mist.
Came close, but didn't make it.
They were very high, 28,250 feet.
Remarkable when you consider the equipment that they had and did not have in those years.
It was absolutely primitive equipment by today's standards. They had no real well-thought-out down gear. They had a very heavy and primitive oxygen apparatus. They climbed in nailed leather boots, cotton windsuits, and wool jackets. And after that failure, the British still returned in 1933 and 1936, twice more to failure. The mountain was closed after the Chinese invaded Tibet in 1950, and so they had to find another route to approach the mountain. And that leads us to the British and Swiss expeditions in the 50s.
David Brashears, before we get back around to Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, some of our listeners will have seen this. Many have not. Everest does not stand alone as a great towering peak. It's part of the Himalayas, obviously. More than 1,000 peaks, I believe, at higher than 20,000 feet. It's been even called a kind of a shy mountain. It doesn't just knock you over the head.
Everest is part of a very large massif. From one angle, it is quite impressive. But from the most commonly seen perspective, from the Khumbu side, the south side of the mountain, the Sherpa homeland, the mountain just barely peaks up 2,000 feet above an intervening horizontal ridge from Nuptse, a 25,000-foot mountain, to Lhotse, the fifth highest mountain on Earth. And so it is part of that massif of Everest, Lhotse, and Nuptse, and one has to try quite hard. You have to hike quite high to get a full picture of the width and height of that mountain. Now, from the north side, from Rongbuk Monastery, and the British attempts in the 20s were all from the north and in the 30s, where there you look up from the Rongbuk Monastery, situated 15 miles from the base of the mountain, and in one mighty sweep from 20,000 feet to 29,038 feet, you see this singular great jawtooth of a mountain, you know, rising up into the sky. It's just a dazzling sight.
The fabled North Face.
The North Face.
Now, I've actually walked across that Tibetan plain down toward Nepal, and there you really feel the tectonic situation here, where all of India is shoving up into the belly of Asia, which has produced the Himalayas over time. And as you say, when it was first surveyed, it was 29,002 feet. Now it's called 29,035, but it's continuing to rise.
Most of that error was due to the fact that the surveyors were, their 10 stations from which they sighted Everest were an average of 108 to 105 miles away. They got those errors corrected to 29,028 feet in the 50s and 60s. But we know from putting GPS equipment on the mountain now that it does rise and will continue to rise a few millimeters a year for many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years into the future.
And into this scene comes in 1953, 50 years ago this year, this month, yet another British climbing party, this one with two New Zealanders along, one of them Edmund Hillary. Who was he? How did he join the party? What was their goal? Were they out to be the first to top Everest?
They were dead set on being the first because they'd got the hell scared out of them the season before. Something very fortuitous happened. After the Chinese closed the Tibetan approach to the mountain from the north, it was the same time when the Nepalese were opening the approach from the south. They had been just as xenophobic for many years as the Tibetans. Now, finally, they said, come in and explore our country. And a reconnaissance expedition was made to the base of the mountain in 1949 by an American and a British team, and they determined there was a feasible way to climb the mountain from the south. The British did a reconnaissance in 1951, of which Hillary was a member, and they ventured a few thousand vertical feet into the ice fall, this formidable tangle of ice spilling over a 40-degree precipice, falling down the slope over 2,000 feet, and they determined they could make their way safely, for the most part safely, through this very dangerous area.
I've seen photographs of that, and I'm not sure the words icefall fully convey just what it looks like and how treacherous it is. Paint that picture, David Brashears.
Well, imagine looking at really a river of ice that's flowing out of a very deep chasm. This river of ice would be several hundred feet thick and about a half a mile wide, and the walls protecting it on either side would make that chasm deeper than the Grand Canyon.
Smooth or choppy, full of crevasses?
At this point, it's full of massive lateral crevasses that we traverse. Once that ice pours out of the Western Coombe, Coombe is a Welsh word for valley or basin. It literally drops off a cliff, a 2,000-foot cliff that ends up at base camp. And that cliff averages 40 degrees in angle. And so you have a river of ice pouring very smoothly out of the Western Coombe and then just becoming a maze of
a jumble.
It's kind of a mess. It doesn't know where it wants to go or when it wants to move, and you have to hope you're not in the wrong place at a time that it decides to collapse.
But these British mountaineers had determined that that could be crossed.
They made their way, and they were very good and experienced snow climbers and ice climbers. But what really scared them was they had a monopoly on Everest. The British were the only ones allowed in through Tibet. And now
a legacy of the British Empire.
Yes, and they were the ones that got the permission from the Dalai Lama to get passports to make their way to Everest in the 20s and 30s. Now the Swiss, excellent mountaineers, had permission to climb Everest to give it two tries.
So the race was on.
In the spring of 52 and the fall of 51. And on May 26th, 1952, Tenzing, with Raymond Lambert, climbed to over 28,100 feet.
Wow. There were only
eight. Yes, and what had happened was their Sherpa support had faltered. They had left the South Col at 26,000 feet and incredibly set up a tent at 27,600 feet on the southeast ridge with no sleeping bag, no pads, no stoves, no water. They huddled and shivered their way through the night and still in the morning managed to go up.
And climb.
And if those two men, Raymond Lambert and Tenzing Norgay, had had a sleeping bag and a stove.
And not been so stiff and so murdered by the night.
Yes. I think we would have seen the first ascent of Everest a year earlier. So when the British got on the mountain in 53, they had to get up.
Now, they came with a lot of gear. They had many Sherpas carrying a ton and a half of gear, as I recall.
More than that. Tons and tons of gear.
Tons of gear, all right.
Hundreds of porters. We used four camps on the mountain. Now, they used nine. This was a military operation, evidenced by the fact that the leader was Colonel John Hunt. And they were supported. They had tremendous support in not only logistics, but in the testing and development of new equipment.
Because this first ascent, successful ascent, had to be British. Now, Edmund Hillary was along.
Well, let me just point out that the Swiss were coming again next, in the next year.
Right.
And they knew that route well.
And they had come so close, they knew what they would need the next time.
Yes.
I didn't know until reading back for this conversation with you, David, that it was not foreordained at all that it would be Edmund Hillary who would be the first to go up. I mean, there was a big climbing crew. How did it happen that he was the one, along with Tenzing Norgay?
He was an obvious choice to be a team member. And they had done quite a bit of training before they left Everest, and Hillary had performed very well in the reconnaissance in 1951. He grew up climbing in New Zealand.
He's called a beekeeper, but he'd done plenty of climbing there.
He was very comfortable on steep, corniced ridges. He was a snow and ice climber. Rock was not his specialty. Snow and ice would be the challenge high up on Everest. But the first summit attempt was not comprised of Tenzing Ed Hillary. Mm-hmm. It was a man named Bourdian and Evans. They left from the South Col, and this is important to note. That high camp is at 26,000 feet. Mm. That is the high camp we continue to use today. They climbed through the morning and got all the way in the late afternoon to the South Summit.
Part of the same expedition, but not
Ed
Hillary.
Same expedition. Mm-hmm. 28,750 feet. 250 feet left to glory, immortality, your name emblazoned in gold.
Forever, and they couldn't do it.
No.
Why?
They were tired, and they weren't sure how they would function should they run out of bottled oxygen on the way down. And this was a heroic attempt. These men had gone beyond any normal limits of determination and endurance and showed an incredible fortitude. So the decision was made for the next summit attempt to place a higher camp. The day was just considered too long. Mm-hmm. And so Hillary and Tenzing, 3 days later, started from 27,500 feet.
So they would have about a 1,600-foot.
They cut the day in half.
And that made it ultimately physically possible. We're going to come back after a short break and hear the details of how they finally made that summit and then be brought up to date. But I was struck, David Brashears, you've written that you were 12 years old when you first saw the picture of Tenzing Norgay standing atop Mount Everest, the famous picture. He's carrying the Tibetan prayer flags, and it stirred something in you like it stirred in many others.
Absolutely. I saw that image, and I was mesmerized and spellbound. My mind could not, fathom a place on our planet where a man needed an oxygen mask and an oxygen tank to survive. I understood that underwater, but these men look like astronauts and a thick down suit.
And all the world falling away beneath them infinitely.
He looked standing there with that ice axe held aloft in triumph as a man standing at the absolute edge of his planet, a very determined man, a very weary man. But what struck me the most about that pose was Tenzing Norgay had done something great, and he was standing exactly where he wanted to be.
And you say you equated from that moment on climbing Everest with man's capacity for hope. We'll come back and talk about that. We're talking tonight about Mount Everest. in the month that is the 50th anniversary of its very first summit by Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzin Norgay. My guest tonight is David Brashears, filmmaker, adventurer, and mountaineer in his own right, has made 4 trips to the summit of Everest. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the first successful summiting of Mount Everest on May 29, 1953, by Edmund Hillary and Tenzin Norgay. Their ascent made headlines around the world. Here's how it was described in the 1953 documentary, The Conquering of Everest.
29,000 feet high. Only 2 men in the world have reached that height on their feet. One of them born in New Zealand, the other born under Everest.
50 years of climbing Mount Everest now behind us, but it was that half a century ago this month when it was first summited by Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzin Norgay. I'm joined this evening by David Brashears, who has himself climbed Everest 4 times, filmmaker, adventurer, mountaineer, extraordinaire. Delighted to have him with us. Many climbers since then, David Brashears, I think something like 1,200 at last count, maybe 175 have died in the attempt or on the way down. But the first time when no one had walked here before, when the colleagues, as you described just before the break, had come close a couple of days before. What was that final passage for these 2 men on the first ascent of Everest? Take us up that last how many feet where they were in territory that had never been touched.
Well, when one thinks about the situation they were in that day, it goes to the core of what mountaineering is and adventure and exploration. And it's about the unknown. And it's about looking ahead onto terrain where no human footstep has ever been made. And so much of climbing is about those moments when one has to conjure up a certain amount of courage and fortitude and step into the unknown, not knowing what the outcome will be. Because I have stood there on the south summit at 28,750 feet 4 times in my lifetime. Twice without fixed ropes, which are now commonly in place in that area to aid the guided climbers. Client. But to think of Sir Edmund Hillary bound to Tenzin with just a rope tied around his waist, no way to properly anchor themselves, crude old ice axes, primitive crampons, maybe not the greatest gear, but tremendous drive and tremendous ambition and having all that motivation that comes from wanting to step into the unknown and to be first. But that ridge is a knife-edge ridge that's mostly horizontal, and interspersed throughout is downsloping rock.
Now, describe this. Is it the one we've all probably seen a photograph that what looks like the last kind of arching rise to the summit? Yeah. It's snowy.
It's snowy, and it's rocky, and it's steep, and it's just absolutely formidable looking, and it is the ultimate barrier to the summit slopes is the Hillary Step. So here on Everest, you're finding some of the hardest climbing, except that found much lower in the icefall at 19,000 feet at 28,800 feet. But more than that, what climbers fear sometimes is exposure. And when you step out onto this narrow ridge to make your way over, the 100 or so yards to the Hillary Step, that's what it's called now. On the right side, the face, the Kangshung face, falls away 10,000 feet to the Kangshung Glacier. To your left, to the south, it falls away 8,000 feet, the southwest face of Everest down into the Western Coombe. Now, both of those options are not good options.
Not at all.
But think of it that these men so trusted each other. Hillary set across cutting steps, very methodically, basketball-sized steps, because their cramponing technique at that time was not as advanced as it is
now. So
they
literally chopped into the snow. Steps.
Yes, and really, if Hillary had fallen, there was no way, no plausible way that Tenzin could have arrested his fall. Nor could Hillary have arrested Tenzin. So
no safety ropes really here, cutting steps and heading up.
But they were in this together, and they were 2 men on a rope, so they were really one. And Hillary got over to the base of the Hillary Step, Of course, it wasn't called that then, mm-hmm. and did one of the more magnificent efforts ever in the history of mountaineering in scaling the Hillary Step, shoving his ice axe into the snow to anchor Tenzing. Up came Tenzing, and then the final 250 feet to the top are much easier, low-angled snow climbing. And, you know, then they were there, and they knew they were there because Hillary said, everything around me pointed down.
Is below me.
Yeah.
David Brashears, you've walked that way. What is it like? Is it obvious where the peak is? Is there, a basketball court-sized area where anywhere could be the highest? Is there one point that's clearly the highest? And what do you see when you stand there?
Well, once one finally wiggles or squirms or stems their way up the Hillary Step and you get your wind back after panting furiously for 3 or 4 minutes, mm-hmm. you have above you a steeply slanted but fairly even slope of snow. And to the right, massive cornices overhang the Kangshung face caused by the jet stream winds that blow 100, 110 miles an hour from west to east. Mm. So we do tend to stay a little bit down the slope from those mm-hmm. cornices. Otherwise, they would break off.
You don't want to be right on the ridge there.
The top is never close enough on Everest. I will tell you that. And there's a few false summits when you think mm-hmm. you must be there. Mm-hmm. And when one finally stands on the top, when I was there first in 1983, I was the 133rd person to climb Everest. Mm-hmm. There was barely room for four of us to sit. It is not a big place. It is a very, very small place. There is slightly more room than that, but you don't dare utilize that space because that's a cornice. And that's the Kangshung face
to
the east.
So you are on snow.
Snow. It's not ice. It could be very hard snow, hardened mm-hmm. by the jet stream winds, but it is snow, not ice.
You've been up 4 times. How much variety did you find? Was it all in this time of the year? Was there variety in the weather at the summit?
I've climbed on the mountain 12 times, but the 4 times I reached the summit, it was by the British 53 route and in the spring, April 30th, May mm-hmm. 7th, and twice on May 26th. Mm-hmm. But you know what made it different was in 1983, there were no fixed ropes above the South Col. Mm-hmm. It was in the same condition as when Hillary first climbed it. When we reached the top, there was no survey tripod. There were no prayer flags tied to the survey. There was no trinkets left behind. There were no oxygen bottles left behind. None of the detritus of all these other expeditions. And really, one could feel as if no one else had ever stood there. And it was just a remarkable moment. And when I climbed it the second time, again, the summit was clear. But that was 1985. But by 1996 and 1997, when you got on top, there was this evidence of all those who had gone before you.
Because, of course, the numbers have gone up and up and up, more or less decade by decade of climbers.
I think last year or the year before on one afternoon, 80 people stood on the top roughly at the same time.
We saw that. It was May 23rd, 2001, 89 climbers summited in one day. That is astonishing. How does that possibly happen? It sounds like a railroad running up there.
It has to happen, first of all, with good weather, but also with teams coming up from the north. You would not get that many climbers up just from the south. Just getting up and across the
too much traffic
from the south summit. By the way, the South Summit, that route from the South Summit to the Hillary Step, many listeners will know that's the site of the traffic jam in 1996 that contributed a bit to that tragedy. I don't know how they do it. I know why they want to be there. I know it's important, but I'm thankful that I didn't have to stand up there and try and find my way through those kinds of crowds.
David Brashears, some lucky number of us have seen what it looks like from up there thanks to your photography and your film work. But describe it for us when you stand on the summit of Mount Everest, presuming it's a clear enough day to see. What do you see?
If it's clear enough, you think you can see halfway across your planet, and it is the most magnificent view in all the world. If you're there at noon, it's not nearly as impressive
because
there's no layering to the earth,
yeah.
no depth
yeah.
to the surface
just
of the earth
of
caused
sun.
By the sun's right overhead.
Mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm.
is May. Everest is the same latitude as Orlando, Florida. The sun gets up overhead fairly quickly.
Yep.
But when I climbed it in 19, 1996 or 1997. We got on top around 8 once and 7 as the sun was coming up.
A.M.
And it's just you see the dawn shadow of Everest cast out on the Earth's upper atmosphere, and you realize the power of that mountain and that view, and that there is no other mountain in the highest mountain range on Earth surrounding you that comes close to the height of Mount Everest. Everything else is down and way down.
Reach out and touch space.
That's right.
1996 was a bad year. Describe what went wrong if the climbing part of it, as I recall, was just ahead of you and yours.
Yeah, we were actually ahead of them for a while at Camp 3. Mm-hmm. At 24,500 feet, the IMAX film team was on its way up, and we were hit with some poor weather, and we thought the mountain is still not ready. And that's the way a climber looks at it. The jet stream may not have left. Let's give the mountain some time. We have the resources, and we have the strength. That wasn't the only part of our decision to go down and wait. We saw 65 people coming up the trail behind us, Scott Fisher's and Rob Hall's team, the Taiwanese, the South Africans, and others. And we didn't want to get caught in a squeeze play high on Everest.
Now, 65 people, does that mean that this was one of the, I don't know what you call it, guided tours?
Yes, but they were, what had happened was that weather window is fairly predictable, and people get in place, like preparing for a battle. You get everything in place.
Lined up,
And now they're ready to go. The weather's there. And they start off up the mountain. There was no original plan that four teams would be traveling together. But then what's led to some of the problems on Everest is this idea of, and it's a tragic idea, of strength in numbers. Mm-hmm. So off we came down. They went up, some of them inexperienced, some of them very experienced. The long and short of it is on that day, and I think it was May 10th, they got caught out late on the mountain. They climbed slowly. They had the so-called traffic jam at 28,700 feet. Many climbers didn't make it down at the same time that a quick-moving, hard-to-predict, fierce wind and snowstorm hit people when they were at their weakest. After having made the summit, straggling down, and eight people perished in that storm. They were left out in the night. They didn't get back to their tents. One person that did survive, Beck Weathers, lost his nose and both his hands. Another person who did survive, Makalu Gao, a Taiwanese climber who bivouacked next to Scott Fisher, who died. He lost most of his fingers, his toes, and all of his nose.
And your friend, the writer John Krakauer, was in one of these groups?
He was in one of the groups. He came down earlier that day. He was up earlier and down earlier, and as the tragedy unfolded, he was in his tent in the South Col at 26,000 feet. As that storm started to tear at the tents and imperil the climbers who hadn't made it to the safety of their tents.
So your group comes along behind, and you decide to go up and investigate what's happening there.
We were down in advanced base camp, and the radio calls came down, and they were very sad and forlorn. And looking back, it was just such a tough moment because Rob Hall was on the radio saying, "Help anyone, please. I'm begging you, please help me. Send oxygen. Doug Hansen has collapsed." That's his client. Mm-hmm. Above the Hillary Step at 28,800 feet, the man had forgotten. The finish line isn't on top. It's on the bottom.
Yeah.
So there was nothing we could do that night except listen to the radio calls. And, of course, the radio calls the next day with Rob, who was stranded, unable to move at 28,700 feet. What we did is we volunteered all our oxygen in the high camps, two other teams. We gave up filming, and we headed back up. We weren't rescuers. We were just trying to lend a hand.
David Brashears, you write a lovely passage in your book, High Exposure, where you describe stepping out of your tent to begin that ascent up the last way on that night. I wonder if you'd be good enough to read a bit of that for us.
It's right here. At 10:35 p.m., I unzipped my tent. No matter how many times I've made this journey, it always begins the same way. It's pitch dark outside as I unzip the door. What little heat has pooled inside spills out into the frigid night air. The sense of safety and security I feel in the tent vanishes with the warmth. On my hands and knees, I crawl into one of the world's most hostile environments and into my ultimate arena, the last 3,000 vertical feet to the summit of Everest. The stars were out that night, but there was no moon. It was dark and cold, minus 30 degrees. The night was still. Looking above, I could barely see the outline of Everest, a dark, lopsided pyramid cut out from the night stars. I sat on a small rock to put on my crampons, which dug into the snow and ice. Barehanded, I checked and rechecked to make sure the heel and toe clips were biting through the thin neoprene of my overboots, an extra layer of insulation over my climbing boots. I hadn't planned on using overboots up there, but after the catastrophe, I felt inordinately vulnerable, not just in the cold, but to my own mortality. I've always relied on strength of mind to drive my body, and the body has always been good with plenty of horsepower. But the deaths in that disastrous climb reminded me that I was 40 years old now. I had borrowed the overboots from a friend, John Krakauer, who had survived the May 10th storm. I walked among the nylon domes of heavy weather tents, hoarsely shouting that it was time to go. The tents were already alive, sides huffing out with movements inside, zipper scraping in the silent night. Sherpas and team members gathered their gear, and I mentally ran through my own checklist one more time. 2 full bottles of oxygen, spare mittens, ice axe, and, most important, my compass fixed with a heading so that even in a storm, I could find my way home.
David Brashear is reading from his best-selling book, High Exposure, recounting one of his 4 ascents to the summit of Everest, one in a very difficult year, 1996, when there were deaths aplenty. We noted earlier, at this point, 1,200 people have climbed Everest. How inexperienced are some of these people?
Well, first I want to say that incredibly, because of the last couple of years' success, that number is up to 1,600.
Oh my gosh,
and
it's spiking.
Yes. You know, some of those people have all the right qualities. They're tough. They're stubborn. They have a high tolerance for pain. They're ambitious, very motivated. But that's not experience. Experience is having been out on Mount Washington here in New Hampshire, right. You know, setting up a tent in high winds, in minus 40, in a 50-mile-an-hour wind, and having to keep track of your mittens in the dark, being able to crampon across easily angled snow is not experience. So if one was to say how qualified are and experienced are many of these people, well, they are woefully unqualified. So then we have to ask, does that mean they shouldn't be on the mountain? Well, that's a question each of them has to ask because really – you have an obligation on the mountain, not only to yourself, to be able to climb the mountain in a safe and self-reliant manner. I think you have a profound obligation to have the experience and the skills to find your way home to those you left behind.
We're talking tonight about Mount Everest. In the month of the 50th anniversary of its first climbing, my guest is David Brashears. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Mount Everest in the month of the 50th anniversary of its very first climbing by Sir Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa climbing companion Tenzing Norgay. My guest tonight, and I'm honored to have him, is David Brashears, filmmaker, adventurer, and mountaineer. Let's listen back to the voice of Sir Edmund Hillary. Here he is, sometime after he made that very first ascent, walking us through that final passage to the summit.
We're starting to slow down a bit. Getting a little tired, and I think we're almost getting a little desperate in our seeking for the summit. Well, I cut round the back of one ridge and round the back of another ridge, and the summit never seemed to be coming any closer. But finally, I cut round the back of another one and saw that the ridge ahead dropped steeply away. So I looked up, and there was a little rounded cone above us, and I knew it was the summit.
Sir Edmund Hillary, describing his climb to the top of Mount Everest with Tenzing Norgay, May 29th, 1953. David Brashears, I wonder about this man, Edmund Hillary. He was the lanky New Zealander. We talked earlier about how it wasn't at all clear when he joined this party of climbers that he would be the one, along with Tenzing Norgay, who was the first to top Mount Everest. In the years since, he's devoted himself to people of Nepal in many ways, built schools and clinics in the territory of the Sherpas there. What place does he hold in climbers' minds today?
Well, Hillary and Tenzing together they're the ones. Their iconic value is so high and so strong that sometimes one can say, do these men really exist? You know, are they real? When I first met Sir Edmund Hillary on an expedition, he was an honorary member in 1981. I wasn't sure that when we showed up to begin our trek that a man named Sir Edmund Hillary would actually come out and show himself.
Like the Yeti or the gods.
Yes. Could he really exist? Right. It's just – and that photo he took of Tenzing on the top is the most important and memorable and iconic photo in the history of mountaineering. But it's interesting you should ask that because many of us measure Sir Edmund Hillary's greatness in all the years that followed because his achievements in working with the Sherpas and uplifting and bettering their lives in Nepal, the mountain he built doing that makes Everest look like a very small mountain indeed.
And I've read him saying the same thing, that ultimately he's 80-something now.
Yes.
And at this age, it's all those human connections and the reaching out he's been able to do with Sherpas that are more important to him than being the first to top Everest.
Yeah, it begs the question of what makes a person great and generous and what leads to a person like Sir Edmund Hillary. Imagine the opportunities afforded that man stepping off the top of Everest with Tenzing in 1953, the way that he could have used that great achievement only to further his own goals and to enrich himself. And yet that man has lived a very modest life. He's unable to return very high on the mountains because of an incident he had in 1960 on Makalu. Nonetheless,
what happened in that incident?
He had to go down back to Kathmandu from another climb he was on. There were some problems now with the permit on Makalu being held up, and then he raced back up to the mountain, and he had sort of a mild stroke or something, and he was never quite the same.
For the super high altitude?
Never. He went on an expedition and crossed Antarctica with tractors. But the fact that he immediately found an outlet for this fame, for his humanity, for his generous nature, and that it could only be directed at helping the people that had helped him and helped that expedition succeed.
In the years since, there have been many climbers and, as I understand it, new approaches to climbing. I read about extreme climbers on and around Everest. What does that mean, David Brashears?
There's the expedition style, siege-style expeditions, which start out with a small army, as I mentioned earlier, and you carefully build camps with fixed ropes between the camps and stock the camps with supplies. And then when you're acclimatized and you have basically this umbilical cord back to the bottom, up you go. Modern climbers, most notably Reinhold Messner, have trained on peaks surrounding the mountain or on the mountain. These are highly trained super athletes to begin with, full-time climbers. Then they get to the base of Everest, and with just the packs on their backs, no supplemental oxygen, no fixed ropes, not a single piece of material placed on the mountain ahead of them.
No 500 Sherpas.
No, they go up and down the mountain literally in 3 days.
To the summit.
Yep, up and down, unsupported. And in 1980, Reinhold Messner, the world's most famed mountaineer, became the first person to solo Mount Everest, and he did it without bottled oxygen, of course. He couldn't carry any from the north side alone during the monsoon season. That's about as far out on the edge as you can get on Mount Everest.
We call that extreme. How on earth does the body adapt to that? I mean, anywhere, most people just in the high teens of thousands start to feel it very severely, let alone 20,000 plus, let alone 26,000 plus. Is it all in the training?
It's in the training, but it's in the time on the mountain. There's an interesting thing about adapting to altitude in that how well you adapt is not determined by your fitness level. But of course, if you are a person who does adapt well and then you are fit, you do have an extra advantage. By the time we climbed the mountain, with or without bottled oxygen, we hope to have been on its slopes for at least 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We have to produce more hemoglobin. Our respiration rate increases. Other changes take place. If I took you to the top of Mount Everest right now and dropped you there, you'd be unconscious in 3 minutes and dead in 10. So
I'll take a pass on that, though I'd love to stand there. David, I wonder what's on your mind as we come to this 50th anniversary. It's a lot of years now, many climbs since then. It's no longer unreachable. It's known. As you say, sometimes you go up now and there's even garbage up there. I guess every time at this point. What do these 50 years say about our relationship with the mountain, with the idea of adventure? And where does that idea stand 50 years on, half a century on from the first summiting of Everest? Does it still live? What does it mean now?
Well, the idea of adventure, of course, lives on. It might not live on in the hearts and minds of every climber now on Mount Everest, but that's not necessarily where you go to find adventure anymore if you're a climber. If we look back to May 29, 1953, it was the end of this glorious idea of what was called the last innocent adventure. The two poles had already been climbed.
North and South Pole reached.
Mm-hmm. And those are just lines basically in the sand, in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
We still had this magnificent edifice, you know, this grandest of all ramparts on Earth that soared so high above its nearest rival, K2. It's 750 feet higher, the limit at which man can climb without a bottled oxygen or with bottled oxygen. And I don't know what we find. That's the big question, so uplifting and edifying about climbing to the tops of great mountains, perhaps because that singular achievement is so clear in our heads, perhaps puts us closer to the heavens. But now Everest is a much different place, not only because the route is known, not only because all of the fixed ropes are in, but because it is no longer the arena of the elite. We could look at Tenzing and Hillary and know we could never
only
be them.
They.
Only they. Mm. And now you can look at the people that climb Everest, you, Tom Ashbrook, and say, well, that person's a lot closer to me than he is to Edmund Hillary.
Yes.
And so that takes away some of the mystery of what it takes to be up there and what it means to be up there. And yet I understand why the 1,000th person has wanted to climb Everest and why the 5,000th person will.
Who wouldn't? But what takes the place of that unreachable summit, of that magnetic, mysterious peak in the clouds?
Many other ascents going on as we speak right now in the spring climbing season in the Himalaya. There's lightweight teams out there pioneering new routes on the giants. There's 14 peaks on our planet above 8,000 meters. And let me tell you, these are dedicated, determined climbers having adventures every bit as rewarding and challenging as Tenzing and Hillary's, but we will never know their names.
Not in that way. There's only one Mount Everest. David Brashears, it's just been tremendous having you this evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
David Brashears, filmmaker, adventurer, mountaineer, four-time climber of Mount Everest, author of High Exposure, An Enduring Passion for Everest and Unforgiving Places. In a moment, Climbing Beyond Darkness, the first blind man to summit Everest. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. At the age of 13, Eric Weinmayer lost his sight from retinoschisis, a rare vision disorder. A summer camp trip a few years later introduced him to rock climbing. Finding footholds on the side of a rock face opened up a new world for Eric. After years of constantly reaching out into darkness, he discovered a new source of inspiration. He is now a world-class mountain climber, one of fewer than 100 climbers to have scaled the fabled seven summits, the highest peaks on each of the seven continents, and the only sightless person to reach the top of Mount Everest. In this radio diary, Eric Weinmayer talks about the experience of climbing higher than the eye can see.
My mountain experience is a close experience. It's not a big, wide, vast experience. You know, I'm not looking out at these sweeping landscapes around me. I'm feeling with my gloves and my boots, or when it's warmer, with bare hands, And I'm sensing the terrain under my feet, the rocks, the snow, the steepness. Sometimes I'm getting into this beautiful rhythm where I'm swinging my ice axe or my ice tool at the ice or the snow, and feeling my body powering up a mountain. It's a very close in, almost an internal sensation, and I absolutely love it. That for me is the view. When I went blind at 13, you know, there's this myth that you are afraid of going blind because you're going to only see darkness for the rest of your life. That's just totally not true. I was afraid mostly of being swept to the sidelines and forgotten. You know, I wanted to be right in the thick of things. I wanted to live a fulfilling life, you know, and climbing for me was just a natural inclination. I loved being in the outdoors. I loved being with friends. I love experiencing nature and, you know, through my hands and feet and with my ears. I think there's a myth that when I climbed Everest, I was, you know, short roped or connected to someone. I climbed Everest the same way anyone else does. Just I was listening to somebody in front of me instead of charting my own path. So you have to just take it step by step, moment by moment. You know, you have a big picture in your mind. You know what you need to do. But yet at the same time, if you think about all the hardship ahead of you, you get really overwhelmed. So you just take it moment by moment and you just plug away. I mean, you're literally, you know, it takes you almost 3 months to climb this mountain. And you just have to literally take it day by day, because there are moments where you really feel like, you know, you want to turn back. I remember I climbed up the Hillary Step. And because I'd been rock climbing for so long, that was the easy part for me, scrambling up the Hillary Step. And I kind of belly flopped my way over the top, and I stood up, and I knew I was only half an hour from the summit. I was counting my breaths. I was taking 6 breaths between each step. And I just kept thinking, take one more step, take one more step. You're going to get there. And I kept kind of, you're always sort of coaching yourself and giving yourself these mantras, like, keep going, you can do it. And I took a step, and the earth sort of flattened out around me. And I could hear this really, that beautiful sound of open space that I remember, you know, the very first time I went rock climbing, that, you know, this sense of almost being swallowed up by sky. And I reached down, I touched the snow, I could hear the prayer flags flapping in the breeze. You're hearing all the wind and all the vastness. And then around me came my team. That day that I summited, we had a couple really exciting things. Sherm Bull on my team was the oldest man in history to summit Mount Everest, 64 years old. In fact, the banner when we got down to Nepal to Kathmandu, the banner in the hotel said, congratulations, oldest man in history to summit Everest, blindest man in history to summit Everest. I think leaders aren't necessarily the fastest, the smartest, the people with the best eyesight. I think leaders are those people who have grown comfortable with the process of reaching into the darkness towards, you know, those immense possibilities that, you know, they may be unseen, yet they're sensed. While I think some people allow that sort of uncertainty to paralyze them, I found through the mountains that to be a good leader, what you need is a degree of skill, of course. You need a vision of who you are, and I think you need a lot of courage. And I think with those three qualities, you can do a lot.
Eric Weinmayer is the author of Touch the Top of the World. For more information on Eric and his climb, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.